maybe had wrought it, and remorse. He saw tears on that once tearless face, more unbearable than wrath. "Do not weep, Lord," he stammered. "Perhaps he will get well. Have you asked Gandalf?"
"Comfort me not with wizards," said Denethor. "The fool's hope has failed. The enemy has found it, and now his power waxes. He sees our very thoughts, and all we do is ruinous. I set my son forth, unthanked, unblessed, out into needless peril, and here he lies with poison in his veins. Nay, nay, whatever may now betide in war, my line too is ending. Even the house of the stewards has failed. Mean folk shall rule the last remnant of the kings of men, lurking in the hills until all are hounded out."
Men came to the door, crying for the lord of the city.
"Nay, I will not come down," he said. "I must stay beside my son. He might still speak before the end, but that is near. Follow whom you will, even the grey fool, though his hope has failed. Here I stay."
So it was that Gandalf took command of the last defence of the city of Gondor. Wherever he came, men's hearts would lift again, and the winged shadows pass from memory. Tirelessly he strode from citadel to gate, from north to south about the wall, and with him went the Prince of Dol Amroth in his shining mail. For he and his knights still held themselves like lords in whom the race of Numenor ran true. Men that saw them whispered, saying, "Belike the old tales speak well. There is elvish blood in the veins of that folk, for the people of Nimrodel dwelt in that land once long ago." And then one would sing amid the gloom some staves of the Lay of Nimrodel, or other songs of the Vale of Anduin out of vanished years. And yet, when they had gone, the shadows closed on men again, and their hearts went cold, and the valour of Gondor withered into ash. And so slowly they passed out of a dim day of fears into the darkness of a desperate night. Fires now raged unchecked in the first circle of the city, and the garrison upon the outer wall was already in many places cut off from retreat. But the faithful who remained there at their posts were few. Most had fled beyond the second gate. Far behind the battle, the river had been swiftly bridged, and all day more force and gear of war had poured across. Now at last, in the middle night, the assault was loosed. The vanguard passed through the trenches of fire by many devious paths that had been left between them. On they came, reckless of their loss as they approached, still bunched and herded, within the range of bowmen on the wall. But indeed, there were too few now left there to do them great damage. Though the light of the fires showed up many a mark for archers of such skill as Gondor once had boasted. Then, perceiving that the valour of the city was already beaten down, the hidden captain put forth his strength. Slowly the great siege towers built in Osgiliath rolled forward through the dark. Messengers came again to the chamber in the White Tower, and Pippin let them enter, for they were urgent. Denethor turned his head slowly from Faramir's face and looked at them silently. "The first circle of the city is burning, Lord," they said. "What are your commands? You are still the Lord and Steward. Not all will follow Mithrandir. Men are flying from the walls and leaving them unmanned."
"Why? Why do the fools fly?" said Denethor. "Better to burn sooner than late, for burn we must. Go back to your bonfire, and I will go now to my pyre, to my pyre. No tomb for Denethor and Faramir, no tomb, no long slow sleep of death embalmed. We will burn like heathen kings before ever a ship sailed hither from the west. The west has failed. Go back and burn."
The messengers, without bow or answer, turned and fled. Now Denethor stood up and released the fevered hand of Faramir that he had held.
"He is burning, already burning," he said sadly. "The house of his spirit crumbles."
Then, stepping softly towards Pippin, he looked down at him.
"Farewell," he said. "Farewell, Peregrine, son of Paladin. Your service has been short, and now it is drawing to an end. I release you from the little that remains. Go now, and die in what way seems best to you. And with whom you will, even that friend whose folly brought you to this death. Send for my servants, and then go. Farewell.
I will not say farewell, my lord, said Pippin, kneeling. And then suddenly, hobbit-like once more, he stood up and looked the old man in the eyes. I will take your leave, sir, he said, for I want to see Gandalf very much indeed. But he's no fool, and I will not think of dying until he despairs of life. But from my word and your service I do not wish to be released while you live, and if they come at last to the citadel, I hope to be here and stand before you and earn, perhaps, the alms that you have given me.
Do as you will, Master Halfling, said Denethor, but my life is broken. Send for my servants. He turned back to Faramir.
Pippin left him, and called for the servants, and they came. Six men of the household, strong and fair, yet they trembled at the summons. But in a quiet voice Denethor bade them lay warm coverlets on Faramir's bed and take it up. And they did so, and lifting up the bed, they bore it from the chamber. Slowly they paced to trouble the fevered man as little as might be, and Denethor, now bending on a staff, followed them, and last came Pippin. Out from the white tower they walked, as if to a funeral, out into the darkness, where the overhanging cloud was lit beneath with flickers of dull red. Softly they paced the great courtyard, and at a word from Denethor halted beside the withered tree. All was silent, save for the rumour of war in the city down below, and they heard the water dripping sadly from the dead branches into the dark pool. Then they went on through the citadel gate, where the sentinels stared at them in wonder and dismay as they passed by. Turning westward, they came at length to a door in the rearward wall of the sixth circle. Fen Holland it was called, for it was kept ever shut, save at times of funeral, and only the lord of the city might use that way, or those who bore the token of the tombs and tended the houses of the dead. Beyond it went a winding road, that descended in many curves down to the narrow land, under the shadow of Mindoluin's precipice, where stood the mansions of the dead kings and of their stewards. A porter sat in a little house beside the way, and with fear in his eyes he came forth bearing a lantern in his hand. At the lord's command he unlocked the door, and silently it swung back, and they passed through, taking the lanterns from his hand. It was dark on the climbing road, between ancient walls and many pillared balusters looming in the swaying lantern beams. Their slow feet echoed as they walked down, down, until at last they came to the silent street, Rath Dinan, between pale domes and empty halls and images of men long dead, and they entered into the house of the stewards and set down their burden. There Pippin, staring uneasily about him, saw that he was in a wide vaulted chamber, draped, as it were, with the great shadows that the little lantern threw upon its shrouded walls, and dimly to be seen were many rows of tables, carved of marble, and upon each table lay a sleeping form, hands folded, head pillowed upon stone. But one table near at hand stood broad and bare. Upon it, at a sign from Denethor, they laid Faramir and his father side by side, and covered them with one covering, and stood then with bowed heads, as mourners beside a bed of death. Then Denethor spoke in a low voice.
"Here we will wait," he said. "But send not for the embalmers. Bring us wood quick to burn, and lay it all about us and beneath, and pour oil upon it. And when I bid you thrust in a torch, do this and speak no more to me. Farewell."
"By your leave, lord," said Pippin, and turned and fled in terror from the deathly house. "Poor Faramir," he thought. "I must find Gandalf. Poor Faramir! Quite likely he needs medicine more than tears. Oh, where can I find Gandalf? In the thick of things, I suppose, and he will have no time to spare for dying men or madmen."
At the door he turned to one of the servants, who had remained on guard there.
"Your master is not himself," he said. "Go slow. Bring no fire to this place while Faramir lives. Do nothing until Gandalf comes."
"Who is the master of Minas Tirith?" the man answered. "The Lord Denethor, or the Grey Wanderer?"
"The Grey Wanderer or no one, it would seem," said Pippin.
And he sped back and up the winding way as swiftly as his feet would carry him, past the astonished porter, out through the door, and on, till he came near the gate of the citadel. The sentinel hailed him as he went by, and he recognized the voice of Beregond.
"Whither do you run, Master Peregrine?" he cried.
"To find Mithrandir," Pippin answered.
"The Lord's errands are urgent, and should not be hindered by me," said Beregond. "But tell me quickly, if you may, what goes forward? Whither has my lord gone? I've just come on duty, but I heard that he passed towards the closed door, and men were bearing Faramir before him."
"Yes," said Pippin, "to the silent street."
Beregond bowed his head to hide his tears. "They said that he was dying," he sighed, "and now he is dead."
"No," said Pippin, "not yet. And even now his death might be prevented, I think. But the lord of the city, Beregond, has fallen before his city is taken. He is fey and dangerous." Quickly he told of Denethor's strange words and deeds. "I must find Gandalf at once."
"Then you must go down to the battle."
"I know. The lord has given me leave. But, Beregond, if you can, do something to stop any dreadful thing happening."
"The lord does not permit those who wear the black and silver to leave their post for any cause, save at his own command."
"Well, you must choose between orders and the life of Faramir," said Pippin. "And as for orders, I think you have a madman to deal with, not a lord. I must run. I will return if I can." He ran on, down towards the outer city. Men flying back from the burning passed him, and some, seeing his livery, turned and shouted, but he paid no heed. At last he was through the second gate, beyond which great fires leapt up between the walls, yet it seemed strangely silent. No noise or shouts of battle or din of arms could be heard. Then suddenly there was a dreadful cry and a great shock, and a deep echoing boom. Forcing himself on against a gust of fear and horror that shook him almost to his knees, Pippin turned a corner, opening on the wide place behind the city gate. He stopped dead. He had found Gandalf, but he shrank back, cowering into a shadow. Ever since the middle night, the great assault had gone on. The drums rolled. To the north and to the south, company upon company of the enemy pressed to the walls. There came great beasts, like moving houses in the red and fitful light. The Mumakil of the Harad, dragging through the lanes amid the fires, huge towers and engines. Yet their captain cared not greatly what they did or how many might be slain. Their purpose was only to test the strength of the defence, and to keep the men of Gondor busy in many places. It was against the gate that he would throw his heaviest weight. Very strong it might be, wrought of steel and iron, and guarded with towers and bastions of indomitable stone, yet it was the key, the weakest point in all that high and impenetrable wall. The drums rolled louder. Fires leapt up. Great engines crawled across the field, and in the midst was a huge ram, great as a forest tree 100 feet in length, swinging on mighty chains. Long had it been forging in the dark smithies of Mordor, and its hideous head, founded of black steel, was shaped in the likeness of a ravening wolf. On its spells of ruin lay. Grond they named it, in memory of the hammer of the underworld of old. Great beasts drew it, orcs surrounded it, and behind walked mountain trolls to wield it. But about the gate, resistance still was stout, and there the knights of Dol Amroth and the hardiest of the garrison stood at bay. Shot and dart fell thick, siege towers crashed or blazed suddenly like torches. All before the walls on either side of the gate, the ground was choked with wreck and with bodies of the slain, yet still driven, as by a madness, more and more came up. Grond crawled on. Upon its housing no fire would catch, and though now and again some great beast that hauled it would go mad and spread stamping ruin among the orcs innumerable that guarded it, their bodies were cast aside from its path, and others took their place. Grond crawled on. The drums rolled wildly. Over the hills of slain a hideous shape appeared, a horseman, tall, hooded, cloaked in black. Slowly, trampling the fallen, he rode forth, heeding no longer any dart. He halted and held up a long, pale sword, and as he did so a great fear fell on all, defender and foe alike, and the hands of men drooped to their sides, and no bow sang. For a moment all was still. The drums rolled and rattled. With a vast rush, Grond was hurled forward by huge hands. It reached the gate. It swung. A deep boom rumbled through the city, like thunder running in the clouds. But the doors of iron and posts of steel withstood the stroke. Then the black captain rose in his stirrups and cried aloud in a dreadful voice, speaking in some forgotten tongue words of power and terror to rend both heart and stone. Thrice he cried. Thrice the great ram boomed, and suddenly upon the last stroke the gate of Gondor broke. As if stricken by some blasting spell, it burst asunder. There was a flash of searing lightning, and the doors tumbled in riven fragments to the ground. In rode the Lord of the Nazgûl. A great black shape against the fires beyond he loomed up, grown to a vast menace of despair. In rode the Lord of the Nazgûl under the archway that no enemy ever yet had passed, and all fled before his face. All save one. There waiting, silent and still in the space before the gate, sat Gandalf upon Shadowfax. Shadowfax, who alone among the free horses of the earth endured the terror, unmoving, steadfast as a graven image in Wrath-Dedan.
"You cannot enter here," said Gandalf, and the huge shadow halted. "Go back to the abyss prepared for you. Go back. Fall into the nothingness that awaits you and your master. Go!"
The black rider flung back his hood, and behold, he had a kingly crown, and yet upon no head visible was it set. The red fires shone between it and the mantle's shoulders, vast and dark. From a mouth unseen there came a deadly laughter.
"Old fool," he said, "old fool, this is my hour. Do you not know death when you see it? Die now and curse in vain."
And with that he lifted high his sword, and flames ran down the blade. Gandalf did not move, and in that very moment, away behind in some courtyard of the city, a cock crowed. Shrill and clear he crowed, recking nothing of wizardry or war, welcoming only the morning that in the sky far above the shadows of death was coming with the dawn. And as if in answer there came from far away another note. Horns, horns, horns! In dark Mindolwin sides they dimly echoed. Great horns of the north wildly blowing. Rohan had come at last! Chapter 5. The Ride of the Rohirrim. It was dark, and Merry could see nothing as he lay on the ground rolled in a blanket. Yet though the night was airless and windless, all about him hidden trees were sighing softly. He lifted his head. Then he heard it again, a sound like faint drums in the wooded hills and mountain steps. The throb would cease suddenly, and then be taken up again at some other point, now nearer, now farther off. He wondered if the watchman had heard it. He couldn't see them, but he knew that all round him were the companies of the Rohirrim. He could smell the horses in the dark, and hear their shiftings and their soft stampings on the needle-covered ground. The host was bivouacked in the pine woods that clustered about Ailenach Beacon,
A tall hill, standing up from the long ridges of the Druadan forest that lay beside the great road in Eastern Orion. Tired as he was, Merry couldn't sleep. He'd ridden now for 4 days on end, and the ever-deepening gloom had slowly weighed down his heart. He began to wonder why he had been so eager to come, when he had been given every excuse, even his lord's command, to stay behind. He wondered, too, if the old king knew that he'd been disobeyed and was angry. Perhaps not. There seemed to be some understanding between Durnhelm and Elfhelm, the marshal who commanded the Eorid in which they were riding. He and all his men ignored Merry and pretended not to hear if he spoke. He might have been just another bag that Durnhelm was carrying. Durnhelm was no comfort. He never spoke to anyone. Merry felt small, unwanted, and lonely. Now the time was anxious, and the host was in peril. They were less than a day's ride from the outwalls of Minas Tirith that encircled the townlands. Scouts had been sent ahead. Some had not returned. Others, hastening back, had reported that the road was held in force against them. A host of the enemy was encamped upon it, 3 miles west of Armondine, and some strength of men was already thrusting along the road and was no more than 3 leagues away. Orcs were roving in the hills and woods along the roadside. The king and Eomer held council in the watches of the night. Merry wanted somebody to talk to, and he thought of Pippin, but that only increased his restlessness. Poor Pippin, shut up in the great city of stone, lonely and afraid. Merry wished he was a tall rider like Eomer, and could blow a horn or something and go galloping to his rescue. He sat up, listening to the drums that were beating again, now nearer at hand. Presently he heard voices speaking low, and he saw dim, half-shrouded lanterns passing through the trees. Men nearby began to move uncertainly in the dark. A tall figure loomed up and stumbled over him, cursing the tree roots. He recognized the voice of the marshal, Elfhelm.
"I'm not a tree root, sir," he said, "nor a bag, but a bruised hobbit. The least you can do in amends is to tell me what is afoot."
"Anything that can keep so in this devil's murk," answered Elfhelm. "But my lord sends word that we must set ourselves in readiness. Orders may come for a sudden move."
"Is the enemy coming, then?" asked Merry anxiously. "Are those their drums? I began to think I was imagining them, as no one else seemed to take any notice of them."
"Nay, nay," said Elfhelm. "The enemy is on the road, not in the hills. You hear the woses, the wild men of the woods. Thus they talk together from afar. They still haunt Druarden Forest, it is said. Remnants of an older time they be, living few and secretly, wild and wary as the beasts. They go not to war with Gondor or the Mark, but now they're troubled by the darkness and the coming of the orcs. They fear lest the dark years be returning, as seems likely enough. Let us be thankful that they're not hunting us, for they use poisoned arrows, it's said, and they are woodcrafty beyond compare. But they have offered their services to Theoden. Even now one of their headmen is being taken to the king. Yonder go the lights. So much I've heard, but no more. And now I must busy myself with my lord's commands. Pack yourself up, Master Bag." He vanished into the shadows. Merry didn't like this talk of wild men and poisoned darts, but quite apart from that, a great weight of dread was on him. Waiting was unbearable. He longed to know what was going to happen. He got up, and soon was walking warily in pursuit of the last lantern before it disappeared among the trees. Presently he came to an open space where a small tent had been set up for the king under a great tree. A large lantern, covered above, was hanging from a bough and cast a pale circle of light below. There sat Theodor and Eomer, and before them on the ground sat a strange squat shape of a man, gnarled as an old stone, and the hairs of his scanty beard straggled on his lumpy chin like dry moss. He was short-legged and fat-armed, thick and stumpy, and clad only with grass about his waist. Meddy felt that he'd seen him before somewhere, and suddenly remembered the Pookal men of Dunharrow. Here was one of those old images brought to life, or maybe a creature descended in true line through endless years from the models used by the forgotten craftsmen long ago. There was a silence as Meddy crept nearer, and then the wild man began to speak, in answer to some questions, it seemed. His voice was deep and guttural, yet to Meddy's surprise he spoke the common speech, though in halting fashion, and uncouth words were mingled with it.
"No father of horsemen," he said. "We fight not. Hunt only. Kill Gorgon in woods. Hate orc folk."
"You hate Gorgon, too. We help as we can. Wild men have long ears and long eyes, know all parts. Wild men live here before stone houses, before tall men come up out of water."
"But our need is for aid in battle," said Aylmer. "How will you and your folk help us?"
"Bring news," said the wild man. "We look out from hills. We climb big mountain and look down. Stone city is shut. Fire burns there outside, now inside too. You wish to come there? Then you must be quick. But Gorgon and men out of far away."
He waved a short, gnarled arm eastward.
"Sit on horse road. Very many, more than horsemen."
"How do you know that?" said Aylmer. The old man's flat face and dark eyes showed nothing, but his voice was sullen with displeasure.
"Wild men are wild, free, but not children," he answered. "I am great headman, Han Burihan. I count many things, stars in sky, leaves on trees, men in the dark. You have a score of scores counted 10 times and 5. They have more. Big fight, and who will win? And many more walk round walls of stone houses."
"Alas, he speaks all too shrewdly," said Theoden. "And our scouts say that they've cast trenches and stakes across the road. We cannot sweep them away in sudden onset."
"And yet we need great haste," said Aylmer. "Munburg is on fire."
"Let Han Burihan finish," said the wild man. "More than one road he knows. He will lead you by road where no pits are, no Gorgon walk, only wild men and beasts. Many paths were made where stonehouse folk were stronger. They carved hills as hunters carve beast flesh. Wild men think they ate stone for food. They went through Druaden to Rimmon with great wains. They go no longer. Road is forgotten, but not by wild men. Over hill and behind hill it lies still under grass and tree. There behind Rimmon and down to Dean, and back at the end to Horsemen's Road. Wild men will show you that road. Then you will kill Gorgon and drive away bad dark with bright iron, and wild men can go back to sleep in the wild woods."
Aylmer and the king spoke together in their own tongue. At length Theoden turned to the wild man.
"We will receive your offer," he said, "for though we leave a host of foes behind, what matter? If the stone city falls, then we shall have no returning. If it is saved, then the orc host itself will be cut off. If you are faithful, Han Burihan, then we will give you rich reward, and you shall have the friendship of the Mark forever."
"Dead men are not friends to living men, and give them no gifts," said the wild man. "But if you live after the darkness, then leave wild men alone in the woods and do not hunt them like beasts any more. Han Burihan will not lead you into trap. He will go himself with father of horsemen, and if he leads you wrong, you will kill him."
So be it, said Theoden.
How long will it take to pass by the enemy and come back to the road? Asked Eomer. We must go at foot pace if you guide us, and I doubt not the way is narrow.
Wild men go quick on feet, said Harn. Way is wide for four horses in Stone-Wayne Valley yonder. He waved his hand southwards. But narrow at beginning and at end. Wild man could walk from here to Dean between sunrise and noon.
Then we must allow at least 7 hours for the leaders, said Eomer. But we must reckon rather on some 10 hours for all. Things unforeseen may hinder us, and if our host is all strung out, it will be long ere it can be set in order when we issue from the hills. What is the hour now?
Who knows? Said Theoden. All is night now.
It is all dark, but it is not all night, said Harn. When sun comes we feel her, even when she is hidden. Already she climbs over east mountains. It is the opening of day in the sky fields.
Then we must set out as soon as may be, said Eomer. Even so, we cannot hope to come to Gondor's aid today. Merry waited to hear no more, but slipped away to get ready for the summons to the march. This was the last stage before the battle. It didn't seem likely to him that many of them would survive it. But he thought of Pippin and the flames in Minas Tirith, and thrust down his own dread. All went well that day, and no sight or sound had they of the enemy waiting to waylay them. The wild men had put out a screen of wary hunters, so that no orc or roving spy should learn of the movements in the hills. The light was more dim than ever as they drew nearer to the beleaguered city, and the riders passed in long files, like dark shadows of men and horses. Each company was guided by a wild woodman, but old Harn walked beside the king. The start had been slower than was hoped, for it had taken time for the riders, walking and leading their horses, to find paths over the thickly wooded ridges behind their camp, and down into the hidden Stone-Wayne Valley. It was late in the afternoon when the leaders came to wide grey thickets stretching beyond the eastward side of Armondine, and masking a great gap in the line of hills that from Nardol to Dean ran east and west. Through the gap, the forgotten Wayne Road long ago had run down, back into the main horseway from the city through Anorion. But now, for many lives of men, trees had had their way with it, and it had vanished, broken and buried under the leaves of uncounted years. But the thickets offered to the riders their last hope of cover before they went into open battle, for beyond them lay the road and the plains of Anduin, while east and southwards the slopes were bare and rocky, as the writhen hills gathered themselves together and climbed up, bastion upon bastion, into the great mass and shoulders of Mindolwin. The leading company was halted, and as those behind filed up out of the trough of the Stone-Wayne Valley, they spread out and passed to camping places under the grey trees. The king summoned the captains to council. Eomer sent out scouts to spy upon the road, but old Harn shook his head.
No good to send horsemen, he said. Wild men have already seen all that can be seen in the bad air. They will come soon and speak to me here.
The captains came, and then out of the trees crept warily other pukal shapes, so like old Harn that Merry could hardly tell them apart. They spoke to Harn in a strange, throaty language. Presently Harn turned to the king.
Wild men say many things, he said. First, be wary. Still many men in camp beyond Dean, an hour's walk yonder.
He waved his arm west towards the black beacon.
But none to see between here and Stone Folk's new walls. Many busy there. Walls stand up no longer. Gorgon knock them down with earth thunder and with clubs of black iron. They are unwary and do not look about them. They think their friends watch all roads. At that Al-Khan made a curious gurgling noise, and it seemed that he was laughing.
"Good tidings," cried Aymer. "Even in this gloom hope gleams again. Our enemy's devices oft serve us in his despite. The accursed darkness itself has been a cloak to us, and now, lusting to destroy Gondor and throw it down stone from stone, his orcs have taken away my greatest fear. The outwall could have been held long against us. Now we can sweep through, if once we win so far."
"Once again I thank you, Han Burihan of the woods," said Théoden. "Good fortune go with you for tidings and for guidance."
"Kill Gorgud, kill orc folk. No other words please wild men," answered Han. "Drive away bad air and darkness with bright iron."
"To do these things we have ridden far," said the king, "and we shall attempt them. But what we shall achieve only tomorrow will show." Han Burihan squatted down and touched the earth with his horny brow in token of farewell. Then he got up as if to depart. But suddenly he stood looking up like some startled woodland animal snuffling a great air. A light came in his eyes.
"Wind is changing," he cried,
and with that, in a twinkling, as it seemed, he and his fellows had vanished into the glooms, never to be seen by any rider of Rohan again. Not long after, far away eastward, the faint drums throbbed again. Yet to no heart in all the host came any fear that the wild men were unfaithful, strange and unlovely though they might appear.
"We need no further guidance," said Elfhelm, "for there are riders in the host who have ridden down to Munnberg in days of peace. I, for one. When we come to the road it will veer south, and there will lie before us still 7 leagues ere we reach the wall of the townlands. Along most of that way there's much grass on either side of the road. On that stretch the errant riders of Gondor reckon to make their greatest speed. We may ride it swiftly and without great rumour."
"Then, since we must look for fell deeds and the need of all our strength," said Éomer, "I counsel that we rest now, and set out hence by night, and so time our going that we come upon the fields when tomorrow is as light as it will be, or when our Lord gives the signal." To this the king assented, and the captains departed. But soon Elfhelm returned.
"The scouts have found naught to report beyond the grey wood, lord," he said, "save 2 men only, 2 dead men and 2 dead horses.
"Well," said Aymer, "what of it?"
"This, lord. They were errand riders of Gondor. Hergon was one, maybe. At least his hand still clasped the red arrow, but his head was hewn off. And this also. It would seem, by the signs, that they were fleeing westward when they fell. As I read it, they found the enemy already on the outwall, or assailing it, when they returned, and that would be 2 nights ago, if they used fresh horses from the posts, as is their wont. They couldn't reach the city and turned back."
"Alas," said Théoden.
"Then Denethor has heard no news of our riding, and will despair of our coming."
"Need brooks no delay, yet late is better than never," said Aymer, "and mayhap in this time shall the old saw be proved truer than ever before, since men spoke with mouth." It was night. On either side of the road the host of Rohan was moving silently. Now the road, passing about the skirts of Mindolwin, turned southward. Far away and almost straight ahead there was a red glow under the black sky, and the sides of the great mountain loomed dark against it.
They were drawing near the Ramas of the Pelennor, but the day was not yet come.
The king rode in the midst of the leading company, his household men about him. Elfhelm's Eorid came next. And now Merry noticed that Durnhelm had left his place and in the darkness was moving steadily forward,
until at last he was riding just in rear of the king's guard. There came a check. Merry heard voices in front speaking softly. Outriders had come back, who had ventured forward almost to the wall. They came to the king.
"There are great fires, lord," said one. "The city is all set about with flame, and the field is all full of foes, but all seem drawn off to the assault. As well as we could guess, there are few left upon the outwall, and they are heedless, busy in destruction."
"Do you remember the wild man's words, lord?" said another. "I live upon the open wold in days of peace. Weedfarer is my name, and to me also the air brings messages. Already the wind is turning. There comes a breath out of the south. There is a sea-tang in it, faint though it be. The morning will bring new things. About the reek it will be dawn when you pass the wall."
"If you speak truly, Weedfarer, then may you live beyond this day in years of blessedness," said Théoden. He turned to the men of his household who were near, and he spoke now in a clear voice, so that many also of the riders of the first Eorad had heard them. "Now is the hour come, riders of the Mark, sons of Eol. Foes and fire are before you, and your homes far behind. Yet, though you fight upon an alien field, the glory that you reap there shall be your own forever. Oaths ye have taken, now fulfill them all, to lord and land and league of friendship."
Men clashed spear upon shield.
"Eomer, my son, you lead the first Eorad," said Théoden, "and it shall go behind the king's banner in the centre. Elfhelm, lead your company to the right when we pass the wall, and Grimbold shall lead his towards the left. Let the other companies behind follow these three that lead, as they have chance. Strike wherever the enemy gathers. Other plans we cannot make, for we know not yet how things stand upon the field. Forth now, and fear no darkness."
The leading company rode off as swiftly as they could, for it was still deep dark, whatever change Weedfarer might forebode. Merry was riding behind Durnhelm, clutching with the left hand, while with the other he tried to loosen his sword in its sheath. He felt now bitterly the truth of the old king's words, "In such a battle what would you do, Meriadoc?" "Just this," he thought. "Encumber a rider, and hope at best to stay in my seat and not be pounded to death by galloping hooves." It was no more than a league to where the outwalls had stood. They soon reached them, too soon for Merry. Wild cries broke out, and there was some clash of arms, but it was brief. The orcs, busy about the walls, were few and amazed, and they were quickly slain or driven off. Before the ruin of the north gate in the Ramas, the king halted again. The first Eorad drew up behind him, and about him on either side. Durnhelm kept close to the king, though Elfhelm's company was away on the right. Grimbold's men turned aside, and passed round to a great gap in the wall further eastward. Medi peered from behind Durnhelm's back. Far away, maybe 10 miles or more, there was a great burning, but between it and the riders lines of fire blazed in a vast crescent, at the nearest point less than a league distant. He could make out little more on the dark plain, and as yet he neither saw any hope of morning, nor felt any wind, changed or unchanged. Now silently the host of Rohan moved forward into the field of Gondor, pouring in slowly but steadily, like the rising tide through breaches in a dike that men have thought secure. But the mind and will of the black captain was bent wholly on the falling city, and as yet no tidings came to him, warning that his designs held any flaw. After a while the king led his men away, somewhat eastward, to come between the fires of the siege and the outer fields. Still they were unchallenged, and still Théoden gave no signal. At last he halted once again. The city was now nearer. A smell of burning was in the air, and a very shadow of death. The horses were uneasy. But the king sat upon Snowmane, motionless, gazing upon the agony of Minas Tirith, as if stricken suddenly by anguish or by dread. He seemed to shrink down, cowed by age. Merry himself felt as if a great weight of horror and doubt had settled on him. His heart beat slowly. Time seemed poised in uncertainty. They were too late. Too late was worse than never. Perhaps Theoden would quail, bow his old head, turn, slink away to hide in the hills. Then suddenly Merry felt it at last, beyond doubt, a change. Wind was in his face. Light was glimmering. Far, far away in the south, the clouds could be dimly seen as remote grey shapes, rolling up, drifting. Morning lay beyond them. But at that same moment there was a flash, as if lightning had sprung from the earth beneath the city. For a searing second it stood dazzling far off in black and white, its topmost tower like a glittering needle, and then, as the darkness closed again, there came rolling over the fields a great boom. At that sound the bent shape of the king sprang suddenly erect. Tall and proud he seemed again, and rising in his stirrups, he cried in a loud voice, more clear than any there had ever heard a mortal man achieve before, "Arise! Arise! Riders of Theoden! Fell deeds awake! Fire and slaughter! Spear shall be shaken, shield be splintered, a sword day, a red day, ere the sun rises! Right now! Right now! Ride to Gondor!" With that he seized a great horn from Guthlaf, his banner-bearer, and he blew such a blast upon it that it burst asunder, and straightway all the horns in the host were lifted up in music, and the blowing of the horns of Rohan in that hour was like a storm upon the plain and a thunder in the mountains. "Ride now! Ride now! Ride to Gondor!" Suddenly the king cried to Snowmane, and the horse sprang away. Behind him his banner blew in the wind, white horse upon a field of green, but he outpaced it. After him thundered the knights of his house, but he was ever before them. Aelmer rode there, the white horse tail on his helm floating in his speed, and the front of the first Eorid roared like a breaker foaming to the shore, but Theoden could not be overtaken. Fey he seemed, or the battle-fury of his fathers ran like new fire in his veins, and he was borne up on Snowmane like a god of old, even as Orome, the great, in the battle of the Valar when the world was young. His golden shield was uncovered, and lo, it shone like an image of the sun, and the grass flamed to green about the white feet of his steed. For morning came, morning and a wind from the sea, and the darkness was removed, and the hosts of Mordor wailed, and terror took them, and they fled, and died, and the hooves of wrath rolled over them. And then all the host of Rohan burst into song, and they sang as they slew, for the joy of battle was on them, and the sound of their singing that was fair and terrible came even to the city. Chapter 6 The Battle of the Pelennor Fields. But it was no orc chieftain or brigand that led the assault upon Gondor. The darkness was breaking too soon, before the date that his master had set for it. Fortune had betrayed him for the moment, and the world had turned against him. Victory was slipping from his grasp, even as he stretched out his hand to seize it. But his arm was long. He was still in command, wielding great powers. King, Ringwraith, Lord of the Nazgul, he had many weapons. He left the gate and vanished. Theoden, King of the Mark, had reached the road from the gate to the river, and he turned towards the city that was now less than a mile distant. He slackened his speed a little, seeking new foes, and his knights came about him, and Daernhelm was with them.
Ahead, near the walls, Elfhelm's men were among the siege engines, hewing, slaying, driving their foes into the fire pits. Well nigh all the northern half of the Pelennor was overrun, and their camps were blazing. Orcs were flying towards the river like herds before the hunters, and the Rohirrim went hither and thither at their will. But they had not yet overthrown the siege, nor won the gate. Many foes stood before it, and on the further half of the plain were other hosts, still unfought. Southward beyond the road lay the main force of the Haradrim, and there their horsemen were gathered about the standard of their chieftain. And he looked out, and in the growing light he saw the banner of the king, and that it was far ahead of the battle with few men about it. Then he was filled with a red wrath, and shouted aloud, and displaying his standard, black serpent upon scarlet, he came against the white horse and the green with great press of men, and the drawing of the scimitars of the Southrons was like a glitter of stars. Then Theoden was aware of him, and would not wait for his onset. But crying to Snowmane, he charged headlong to greet him. Great was the clash of their meeting. But the white fury of the Northmen burned the hotter, and more skilled was their knighthood with long spears and bitter. Fewer were they, but they clove through the Southrons like a firebolt in a forest. Right through the press drove Theoden, Thingol's son, and his spear was shivered as he threw down their chieftain. Out swept his sword, and he spurred to the standard, hewed staff and bearer, and the black serpent foundered. Then all that was left unslain of their cavalry turned and fled far away. But lo, suddenly in the midst of the glory of the king his golden shield was dimmed. The new morning was blotted from the sky. Dark fell about him. Horses reared and screamed. Men cast from the saddle lay grovelling on the ground.
"To me! To me!" cried Theoden.
"Up, Eorlingus! Fear no darkness!" But Snowmane, wild with terror, stood up on high, fighting with the air, and then with a great scream he crashed upon his side. A black dart had pierced him. The king fell beneath him. The great shadow descended like a falling cloud, and behold, it was a winged creature. If bird, then greater than all other birds, and it was naked, and neither quill nor feather did it bear, and its vast pinions were as webs of hide between horned fingers, and it stank.
A creature of an older world, maybe it was, whose kind, lingering in forgotten mountains, cold beneath the moon, outstayed their day, and in hideous aerie bred this last untimely brood, apt to evil. And the Dark Lord took it, and nursed it with fell meats, until it grew beyond the measure of all other things that fly, and he gave it to his servant to be his steed. Down, down it came, and then, folding its fingered webs, it gave a croaking cry, and settled upon the body of Snowmane, digging in its claws, stooping its long, naked neck. Upon it sat a shape, black-mantled, huge and threatening. A crown of steel he bore, but between rim and robe naught was there to see, save only a deadly gleam of eyes. The Lord of the Nazgul. To the air he had returned, summoning his steed ere the darkness failed, and now he was come again, bringing ruin, turning hope to despair, and victory to death. A great black mace he wielded. But Theoden was not utterly forsaken. The knights of his house lay slain about him, or else, mastered by the madness of their steeds, were borne far away. Yet one stood there still. Dernhelm the young, faithful beyond fear, and he wept, for he had loved his lord as a father. Right through the charge, Merry had been borne unharmed behind him, until the shadow came. And then Windfaller had thrown them in his terror, and now ran wild upon the plain. Merry crawled on all fours like a dazed beast, and such a horror was on him that he was blind and sick. "King's man! King's man!" his heart cried within him. "You must stay by him. As a father you shall be to me," you said. But his will made no answer, and his body shook. He dared not open his eyes or look up. Then out of the blackness in his mind he thought that he heard Dejanhelm speaking. Yet now the voice seemed strange, recalling some other voice that he had known. "Begone, foul Dwimmerlake, Lord of Carrion, leave the dead in peace." A cold voice answered, "Come not between the Nazgul and his prey, or he will not slay thee in thy turn. He will bear thee away to the houses of lamentation beyond all darkness, where thy flesh shall be devoured, and thy shriveled mind be left naked to the lidless eye." A sword rang as it was drawn. "Do what you will, but I will hinder it, if I may."
"Hinder me, thou fool! No living man may hinder me."
Then Merry heard of all sounds in that hour the strangest. It seemed that Dejanhelm laughed, and the clear voice was like the ring of steel. "But no living man am I. You look upon a woman. Eowyn I am, Aelman's daughter. You stand between me and my lord and kin. Begone, if you be not deathless, for living or dark undead, I will smite you if you touch him." The winged creature screamed at her, but the ringwraith made no answer, and was silent, as if in sudden doubt. Very amazement for a moment conquered Merry's fear. He opened his eyes, and the blackness was lifted from them. There, some paces from him, sat the great beast, and all seemed dark about it, and above it loomed the Nazgul lord like a shadow of despair. A little to the left, facing them, stood she whom he had called Dejanhelm. But the helm of her secrecy had fallen from her, and her bright hair, released from its bonds, gleamed with pale gold upon her shoulders. Her eyes, grey as the sea, were hard and fell, and yet tears were on her cheek. A sword was in her hand, and she raised her shield against the horror of her enemy's eyes. Eowyn it was, and Dejanhelm also. For into Merry's mind flashed the memory of the face that he saw at the riding from Dunharrow. The face of one that goes seeking death, having no hope. Pity filled his heart, and great wonder, and suddenly the slow, kindled courage of his race awoke. He clenched his hand. She should not die, so fair, so desperate. At least she should not die alone, unaided. The face of their enemy was not turned towards him, but still he hardly dared to move, dreading lest the deadly eyes should fall on him. Slowly, slowly he began to crawl aside, but the black captain, in doubt and malice intent upon the woman before him, heeded him no more than a worm in the mud. Suddenly the great beast beat its hideous wings, and the wind of them was foul. Again it leapt into the air, and then swiftly fell down upon Eowyn, shrieking, striking with beak and claw. Still she did not blench. Maiden of the Rohirrim, child of kings, slender but as a steel blade, fair but terrible. A swift stroke she dealt, skilled and deadly. The outstretched neck she clove asunder, and the hewn head fell like a stone. Backward she sprang, as the huge shape crashed to ruin, vast wings outspread, crumpled on the earth, and with its fall the shadow passed away. A light fell about her, and her hair shone in the sunrise. Out of the wreck rose the black rider, tall and threatening, towering above her. With a cry of hatred that stung the very ears like venom, he let fall his mace. Her shield was shivered in many places, and her arm was broken. She stumbled to her knees. He bent over her like a cloud, and his eyes glittered. He raised his mace to kill. But suddenly he too stumbled forward with a cry of bitter pain, and his stroke went wide, driving into the ground. Merry's sword had stabbed him from behind, shearing through the black mantle, and passing up beneath the hauberk, had pierced the sinew behind his mighty knee. "Eowyn! Eowyn!" cried Merry. Then, tottering,
Struggling up, with her last strength she drove her sword between crown and mantle as the great shoulders bowed before her. The sword broke sparkling into many shards. The crown rolled away with a clang. Eowyn fell forward upon her fallen foe. But lo! The mantle and hauberk were empty. Shapeless they lay now on the ground, torn and tumbled, and a cry went up into the shuddering air, and faded to a shrill wailing, passing with the wind, a voice bodiless and thin that died, and was swallowed up, and was never heard again in that age of this world. And there stood Meriadoc the Hobbit in the midst of the slain, blinking like an owl in the daylight, for tears blinded him. And through a mist he looked on Eowyn's fair head, as she lay and did not move. And he looked on the face of the king, fallen in the midst of his glory. For Snowmane in his agony had rolled away from him again, yet he was the bane of his master. Then Merry stooped and lifted his hand to kiss it, and lo! Theoden opened his eyes, and they were clear, and he spoke in a quiet voice, though laboured.
"Farewell, Master Hallbitler," he said. "My body is broken. I go to my father's, and even in their mighty company I shall not now be ashamed."